I'd like to welcome you to today's experience with the Southern Alberta Council on Public Affairs. We're very fortunate to have a very interesting subject matter to speak with. Before I get to that, though, I'd like to introduce myself as the moderator. My name's Cameron McLennan, and I'm happy to be here, and of course, this is something that I'm very interested in personally. I would like to remind you, as individuals, we have an opportunity to enjoy some time together to share lunch. There's a $10 per person cost, and there'll be some baskets circulated to seek to recover those funds. I want to remind everyone that SACPA is a volunteer nonprofit organization and relies on the contribution of members and session attendees to continue its work. We're fortunate to have a long history of partnership. Shaw TV does some short interviews and promotion of sessions. The University of Lethbridge distributes notices, and the Lethbridge College Communication art students record the audio to be posted on the SACPA website. Of course, we'd like to thank Erickson's Restaurant for its continuing support and for preparing the lunch. Today, we're going to have a fascinating discussion about brain mists. Our presenter is Patty Sorensen. She grew up in Red Deer and is a family member of a family full of pilots. It suggests that she didn't realize that everyone else's family didn't know how to fly until she was about 10 years old. Now, she pursued an interest in speech pathology, first leading her to the University of Alberta, where she received a Bachelor of Science in Speech Pathology and Audiology. She then went to University of Western Ontario, where she received a Master's in Science in Speech-Language Pathology. And then to the University of New Brunswick. She's moving further east as she goes, in adult education. She returned to the area and in 1999 started to work at the Barron's Eureka Warner Health Unit as a speech pathologist and subsequently for the Chinook Health Region. She returned to the University of Lethbridge to obtain her PhD in neuroscience and is currently finishing her PhD here in Lethbridge. Her dissertation focuses on brainwave activity in adults with fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. If you're not sure what that is, you're going to find out in short order. And she's recently started a neurofeedback and research office in Lethbridge called NeuroAdvances. I would appreciate if you would join with me in welcoming Patty and giving her a warm SACPA welcome, Patty Sorensen.
Well, I get to start off the afternoon having made a wonderful mistake in that I didn't quite convey that I was going to do a PowerPoint. And actually, it's more for my benefit to remember what I was going to say than for your benefit. Now, my kids would tell me that that was a senior moment, but I'd kind of object a little bit to that. So if you'll have to bear with me if I happen to stray a little bit. The brain is probably something that people have been interested in since, you know, we knew about it, and myths have been around basically since we knew about the brain. There's a few of the myths that, you know, go around, and they're not too bad, but there are other myths that have gone around that have had huge impacts on society in general, on our beliefs and government policies. I'm going to try and limit it to about three. The first one is one that we still see everywhere. Use it? Am I close now? How's that? That's better? Is this idea that we only use 10% of our brain? Now, the way that we are developed is you don't have 90% of your brain waiting in the background just in case you might need it. We use all of our brain. There are a lot of sayings that, you know, imply that we don't, and your parents have probably at times implied that you don't, and you've probably implied that your children don't, but they actually do. If you want to use more than 10% of your brain, all you have to do is open your eyes or close your eyes or think about anything. Or sit up straight. All of those require the brain working together. So, for example, if you're actually looking at something, the image goes from your eye to the back of the brain where it is detected. If it's something that you recognize, an object, the The information then gets sent to the temporal lobe, which is kind of behind your ear. In the context of where you're seeing it, the information gets sent to the temporal lobe behind your other ear. You then recognize what it is, and that goes up into what's called the parietal lobe. You decide what you're going to do, whether you like it, whether you want it, da-da-da. That goes into the prefrontal up here. And if you decide an action, that then goes to the motor area, strip here, and that sends the messages to the muscles. And that happens all within 600 milliseconds. Your brain is working all of the time, and it works all of the time when you're sleeping also. So if you see all of these marketing programs and things that say, we'll help you, you know, you use more than 10% of your brain, you can pay the money to me instead. Sorry, I keep forgetting to get up that close. One of the other really big myths is this whole idea of left brain, right brain. So we see, you know, women are better at language and women are lousy at math, and men are good at math and science and spatial navigation, and women can't find their way out of a, you know, brown paper bag. Drawing on the right side of the brain, the whole idea that if you want to be able to draw, you have to shut off your left side and, you know, the words. And all of that completely eliminates the idea that the brain is more of a more. It's not an either or. So women, when they're talking, use left brain and also your right brain. Men, when you're talking, use left brain and also your right brain. It's just you happen to activate the right brain slightly more than women do. Women happen to activate actually both sides slightly more than men do. It's not a case that, you know, men do one thing and women do another thing. It's the degree. Now, there are some differences. I mean, hormones do alter your brain, and different experiences alter your brain. But one of the things that we're finding is it's much more of a preference as opposed to an ability. So it's not a case that women can't find their way out of a brown paper bag. It's a case that the strategy they use is their preference. So when I was first learning to drive, I was dating a farm boy. And he was trying to teach me, you know, how to navigate the back roads. So one night he was saying, okay, find the North Star. I said, well, I can find the North Star. So he said, which way is north? I thought, well, up. I don't know. This really isn't helping too much. So then the next strategy was say, okay, at every corner, you know, find a landmark. So the second trip I found out that never choose cattle in a field as a landmark. Because they move on you. So even now, I mean, if I'm on the parking lot, you know, I'll say, okay, Chapters is over here, Michael's is over here, my car is here. But when I'm at work, my car is around the corner. And I don't have to worry about how far it is or whereabouts because I'll see it. So I use a different strategy, and that one's fine because I really don't care if it takes me, you know, a few minutes longer to get to my car unless it's minus 40. But if I have to use, quote unquote, the male strategy, I can. I just don't bother. Okay? One of the things, and also to realize with a lot of testing and the probably the biggest or the one that has caused the most lasting negative impact is the idea that girls can't do math. It had huge, you know, implications in terms of schooling and in terms of professions and what professions women went into. And if you look at it, what happened is girls tend to have a narrower range of scores, and boys tend to have a wider range of scores. So what happens is that if you look at the top end, you tend to see more males than females. It's not that females aren't there. It's just that they're outnumbered. What was conveniently forgot is that in addition to having more males who were better, we also had more males who couldn't do math than females. But that part was never put in any government policy. And unfortunately, what ended up is that was then translated that if you were female in school and had problems with math, it was because you were a girl. And if you were a boy who had problems with math, well, we better show you again. And it became a self-fulfilling prophecy. And what they looked at, there's a study down in the States, and what they looked at were all of the students from 12 to 14 who scored above 700 on a scholastic achievement test. So those are the kids who scored at a score where they're 1 in 1,000. And in 1980, there was 13 boys for every one girl who scored at that range. Since 1980, though, there has been that huge push to get women into traditional professions and get, you know, girls to stay in the sciences in high school. And when they did it last year, it was 3-1. So it shows a couple of things. Is one, intelligence is not something that's fixed. And a thing that's very important for people to realize is that, you know, you are definitely, you know, born with some abilities, but the brain is incredibly plastic and malleable, and you can do lots with it. And so you can teach people all sorts of skills that we assume that they couldn't learn. And girls with math, you know, is definitely one of them. They also did one because girls, spatial navigation, they did it with college students, and they trained them for only 10 hours over 3 or 4 weeks, males and females, on a first-person World War II video game. And so when you're in the video game first-person, you know, you have to remember, well, the tank's behind me, and, you know, the enemy's over here and this, and keep everything in your mind spatially as to where everything is. And after only 10 hours, the girls scored equivalent with the males on all of the tests of spatial abilities. So again, it's looking at the fact that, you know, what we expect to see, we're going to see, but if we expect that people can do these types of things with training, they can. And again, it's not the left brain, right brain, girls can, boys can, whatever. And as a complete aside, when you look at language, there's a rumor going around that men are much more of a gossip than girls are, or women are. So we're going to have to look at language a little more closely, too, just to see what's going on there. The other really, really damaging myth that is coming right to the forefront right now is those associated with aging. And the whole idea that a massive cognitive decline with aging, you know, and in literally one or two generations, we have gone from seeing the elderly as a source of wisdom to the elderly as a potential Alzheimer's victim. And I'm not in any way minimizing, you know, the devastation that's associated with Alzheimer's or with any of the dementias, but we have gotten on a real, like, fear-mongering attitude towards aging and mental abilities. A few of the things, I mean, there are some things that do go with time. Yeah, you all know that. I know that. My kids definitely know that I've lost a few things with time. But we seem to have focused in taking normal events and given them a completely different meaning when they're done by someone who's 65 as opposed to someone who's 30. I mean, you know, for example, I can bet you $100 that my 12-year-old daughter loses her glasses more often than anyone in this room. And no one ever says, oh, that was a senior's moment. And no one here probably has ever sat on their glasses either, you know. But so you take an event, and it's that we all of a sudden have given it an incredibly negative twist when we're talking about the senior citizens and individuals over 65, 75. 85. A couple of things. Processing speed does decrease with age. So it does take longer to react to things. It does take longer to think something through. Vocabulary will continue to increase throughout your age span. So you can actually have a better vocabulary at age 90 than you did at 20. Your general knowledge can continue to increase. And you can have better general knowledge and what they call crystallized intelligence in your 90s than you did in your 20s. Multitasking is an interesting one because, again, it's given a negative connotation when you talk about elderly, and it's given a positive connotation when you talk about younger individuals. Elderly do have difficulty multitasking. But one of the things that you have to look at is it actually difficulty multitasking, or is it difficulty blocking out background things that are going on, which is known to increase with age. The other thing is there's a complete misnomer about multitasking. You actually are not doing two things simultaneously. You're switching back and forth between several tasks quickly. So if, for example, you know, you're making supper and the phone rings, you go and answer the phone. And then you all of a sudden realize that the pot's boiling over, so you pause the conversation on the phone while you deal with the thing on the stove. And then your child comes in and you forget about the stove for a minute while you talk to the child. It's not that you're doing three things simultaneously. It's that you're alternating very quickly between three things. And alternating is something that decreases with age. It takes longer to switch from one task to the other. But the other thing when you think about multitasking is there's an assumption that if you can multitask, you're doing all of those equally as well as if you're doing them one at a time. And you can ask any RCMP or city police officer whether someone who's multitasking by talking on the cell phone and driving is doing equally well at both of them, and they will give you a very different story. But when we do talk about the younger people with multitasking, it's seen as this positive, and I don't think that's quite the right approach to take. Now I just have to slip through my slides and see what else I was going to say. How am I doing? One of the things, I should know this, I spent the last 6 years doing it. Electroencephalography, which is a fancy way of saying brainwaves, but we say electroencephalography because it makes us feel important, is what we do up at the university. And the University of Lethbridge has an amazing facility for looking at brainwave activity. I mean, and it is amazing, world-class facility, regardless of size. And it's absolutely phenomenal when you actually think of the size of the university. And I'm not exaggerating, and that's not a brain map. Now, looking at brainwave activity, what we can see is that, one, there are a lot of different brainwaves that function together. So you can have very high-frequency brainwaves. Oh, actually, I'll back up a minute. Your brain has billions of cells, and each cell basically operates like a little battery. And when you have a group of cells operating together, it creates an electrical current. And we can actually see the electrical current will pass through the skull, and we can pick it up on the scalp, and then we multiply it 30,000 times so we can actually see it and analyze it. And then what we do is look at the pattern of electrical activity while you're doing a task. So when I worked with fetal alcohol individuals, we would do memory tasks on the computer, and then we'd watch to see the brainwave activity for when they solved the task, and then compare it to individuals who didn't have fetal alcohol and what their brainwave pattern was, and then how does it differ. And that's for several reasons. One is if we have a better idea of how individuals with disabilities are processing information, then we have a better idea of how we're going to treat them. And that's, you know, important regardless of whether it's fetal alcohol, regardless of whether it's a stroke, a head injury due to a car accident, autism, all of those types of things. You can look at the brainwave pattern. The other thing, especially with the fetal alcohol, is we're looking to see if there's a distinctive pattern that we can use to diagnose them. Because right now, to get a diagnosis of fetal alcohol syndrome, you must have a history of the mother drinking. And when a lot of these individuals are in the foster care system or were adopted, we often don't have that. And if you don't have the label in Alberta, you don't get the funding. So if there's a way that we can objectively say, if you have this pattern, you have fetal alcohol, then it simplifies things. One thing that people don't realize, though, is you can actually train yourself to alter your brainwave activity, just like you can train yourself to lower your heart rate. And there are, well, this is bias alert, because I do neurofeedback training. And what it is you look at the brainwave pattern, because when the brain adapts to things like a head injury or stroke, it doesn't always adapt in a way that's good for you. And you look at the brainwave pattern and what it should be, and then you work at getting the brainwave pattern more, you know, normalized or as close to as we can for that person. Now, marketing has really jumped on the bandwagon on this, and it's a really good example of misapplication, and it will become a brain myth at some point down the time, where they have found that different frequencies are associated with different behaviors. So, for example, the electrical activity of the current in a room is 60 hertz. Alpha, which is seen in people who meditate and who are calm, is around 10 hertz. So it's a very nice slow waveform. And you can train people to increase their alpha to get them to relax. And it's actually done a lot with professional athletes before big meets. But you can now buy CDs that, you know, claim to teach your brain how to relax. All you have to do is put this in the computer and listen to it, and you know, everything will be wonderful. And I actually did bring one, because I buy them just to see what they are, right? And it is 60 minutes of beep, 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 beep. And I listened to the whole 60 minutes waiting for something to happen, right? And the main thing that happened is I had a massive headache at the end of 60 minutes listening to this little beep. But what it was is the beep was 10 hertz. It was 10 per second, with the idea that if you're listening to this, then the brain will start firing at 10 hertz, and then you'll become this warm, you know, calm, relaxed person. Now, what they've done is there is actually research that if you listen to a 10 hertz beep, your auditory cortex, that part of your brain that detects sounds, will start firing at 10 hertz. But that's not the part of the brain that gets you anxious. That's the prefrontal cortex. So it's got a long ways to go before it hits the prefrontal cortex. And unfortunately, if your entire brain is operating at the same frequency, we call that a seizure. So you don't really want to be doing this. Now, the sounds aren't bad. You can also get the lights, and I've seen them on eBay for about $700. And it's instead of a beep, you see a light flashing. And those ones will set off a seizure. And, you know, don't even try them for fun. But it's one way that the myth is, if you have alpha, you are relaxed. Therefore, we're going to, you know, produce this alpha waveform in you. And what it is doing in people susceptible to stroke or to seizure is setting off seizures. The brain was not designed to work at all one frequency. The brain was designed to work at different frequencies that then coordinate, information so that you can process things. The interesting thing with brainwave activity, though, is you can take the same theories and the same processes and do what's called brain-computer interface. So if you can train someone to alter their waveform at will, what you do is set it up with a computer. And so if they have their brainwave within a certain frequency, the cursor will go up or down. And if it's a different frequency, the cursor will go left or right. So someone who is a paraplegic, who has no muscle movement, you can actually set up a computer screen and have, like, the TV as one icon and the telephone as one and the lights or the radio. And by altering their brainwave activity, they can move the cursor to those pictures. It will open up and then turn on the TV or turn down the volume or open up a word processor so they can send email. So and you can do all of that just with brainwave activity. And so that is one way where, one direction that we're going, and we're actually stealing all of our ideas from the video game industry, because that's what they're doing. They are, as far as I can tell, trying to produce the ultimate couch potato, where you don't even have to move your arm or your finger to be able to, you know, play a video game. You can just sit there and think of where you want, you know, the little person to go. They've also done it with robotic arms and little robots, where you can direct a little robot on the floor just using your brainwave activity. And, well, there's one commercial, but they use it to get beer out of the fridge, so I'm not sure. This is how myths get started. And people drink too much beer when they're playing on their computers. The other thing with brainwave activity that is coming in, and it's actually isn't a myth, is lie detection. Now, it's not at a point where we can use it reliably, but it is coming. So one of the things, I mean, if you're a good criminal, you can beat the standard lie detection test. Because what it does is it relies on the fact that if you're lying, your heart rate is going to increase and you're going to start sweating. Now, you know, if you're a good criminal, lying really shouldn't send your heart rate doing anything. You know, you shouldn't start sweating. If you're honest, it will. But, you know, if you're a good criminal, it won't. But your brain will give you away. So what happens right now is you can show someone a picture, and if they recognize the picture, you will see one type of brainwave pattern. If they don't recognize the picture, you see a different type of brainwave pattern. And the idea is to get this to a point where you can show someone a picture of the crime scene, and if they recognize it, they will get one type of brainwave pattern, even if they say no. And then you can tell that they're lying. Now, it's not at that point. Right now, because brainwave activity contains everything, so when I record brainwave activity, not only am I recording the brain doing whatever task is on the computer, but we're also recording thoughts like, boy, this is boring, when's it going to be over? Oh, whose phone just rang? Oh, I forgot to turn the stove off. you know, brainwave so that you're sitting up and not sliding off your chair. And we have to filter all of that through to actually find out the part that we want. And so we have all of this wonderful information about brainwave activity, but we actually only know maybe about 5% of what it actually means. Do not take that as we only use 5% of our brainwave activity. It's just we only know what 5% of it is doing. So when you hear some things about, you know, lie detection test and video gaming, you know, through brainwave activity, it's coming. That actually isn't a myth. It will be showing up on your doorstep fairly soon. That's all I can remember. So I'll quit there. Thank you.